Good afternoon. You're listening to Scariff Bay Community Radio, and this is Local Media This Week, the programme where we look at all the local print media here in County Clare, Clare Champion, Clare Echo, the Clare Herald, and we give our own take and we have a chat about what kind of things are in the print media this week. And we urge everybody, all our listeners, to support our local print media here in County Clare. I'm joined, my name is Jim Collins, and I'm joined as usual by my three co-presenters here in Scariff Bay Community Radio. First of all, John S. Kelly. John, good afternoon to you.
Afternoon, Jim.
Pat O'Brien, who started this whole ball rolling back a few months ago. Thank you. You're welcome, Pat.
Good afternoon, Jim.
And again, I was going to say our guest, but he's not our guest anymore. He's kind of made himself at home. And that's David Fleming. David, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
David, you spotted a piece about Scariff Bay Community Radio. We might as well start with that and get it out of the way.
That's right. It's not every day that the Scariff Bay FM gets into the newspapers. So it says here in the Clare Champion, well done to the radio station for a very prestigious award, a gold award for technical production at this year's CREAL National Radio Awards. And it's important to emphasise that this was a national award that the station won, and the radio won it for a drama titled Mr. MacGuffin's Plot, Device and Writer Unblocking Emporium, written by Tara Sparling. And I just want to add my congratulations to everybody involved. I know, Jim, you were involved in it, so congratulations to you.
No,
as well.
From
a technical point of view.
No,
involved. I take my congratulations back.
But my involvement was I kind of stood back out of the way and I let the experts tear into it. So,
but it's a great success.
Yeah, Ono Hagen really did a huge amount of work. Even during the week, I was talking to somebody from Liffey Sound FM in Dublin, a community station there. And now he rang me about something else, but he was talking about the play and how impressed he was when he heard it. He couldn't believe the whole sound effects and everything that went with it, which, of course, in a radio play helps to carry the story.
Of course.
And not just helps, but is crucial in carrying the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Owen put an enormous amount of work into it.
And tell me, in adding my own words of appreciation and congratulations to the whole team. We've already been talking to them, okay? But no harm to reiterate it. We feel so proud, and I think rightly so. The whole radio station shares in that. I'm thinking, Jim, it came at the right time as the PR work starts on the promotion of the drama, the Clare Drama Festival or Radio
Festival,
run by the radio. Will a competing team have to hand in the total, we won't have to do any of the hard work or any of the technical work, you know?
No.
It'll come in ready to send out.
It would.
So because,
I mean, in any competition, the work we'll say that's presented would have to be the group's own work, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if we had to, let's say, apart from the time element and the work element, which would be huge for any play, but we'd get blamed then if they didn't win, because what we did would probably, spoil it in some way. So the work comes in finished.
Doesn't it underline the extraordinary talent that lies latently, or even more openly, in communities across the country? Mm. I mean, we're just a small group of volunteers. Mm. How many altogether are involved in the promotion of Scariff Bay Community Radio, roughly?
About 60. There's about 60
now,
people
think
involved.
About that. Mm.
Now, some are here every day or three or four times a week. Others get called on maybe once every couple of months. So there's a lot of... Yeah. But it takes everybody.
It does.
Mm. You know, I mean, if you're in Tulla and you're, for example, are in Whitegate, and you're called every so often to give the news from Whitegate. I mean, without you, we wouldn't be able to give the news from Whitegate.
Yeah.
So it is very, very important to have, you know, to have a lot of people involved.
David, the sociologists in academia would clearly find, material for serious research.
Oh, definitely.
On radio, community radio.
Oh, certainly, and the effect it has and the importance it probably has for, especially at times of crisis like the one we're having at the moment, and that connection for people who, as we know, under all these levels of restrictions, the radio is probably one of the few that connects people to their friends, their neighbours and their community. And their county, of course, and this part of the county in particular, East Clare. I'm reminded of another little piece in the paper as well. It reminded me of the four of us gentlemen. Today, we're recording this on Thursday before it is released on the Sunday. But today, Thursday, is International Men's Day, and the 19th of November. And there's a report here in the Champion. Timmy wants to get men talking. Well, he's done a great job already if he was talking to us. we love talking. But that's the great thing. I was reflecting about the radio at the weekend when I was tuned in. And I was thinking of the eclectic mix of broadcast that goes out, almost everything. And I think that's what sociologists would be psychologists would be interested in, the types of things that interest a community as reflected through the radio.
I suppose one of the things about East Clare, and I'd say, Pat, you'd agree with me on this, is the sense of community and community involvement right around East Clare, from Whitegate to Six Mile Bridge or whatever, Killaloe to Tulla. Huge amount of involvement, people giving up their time. And it's that, I think, the fact that that's there already is a huge help to the radio. And maybe the radio adds to it a bit. But I think the fact that that community spirit, community involvement and community looking after itself, I think that gives the radio a great fillip.
Oh, it does, yeah, yeah. And suppose, like in every parish, you have the GAA and you have handball and you have all the sports organisations, but then you have community councils as well, and you have groups looking after the older people, and maybe at Christmas a big doing dinners and all that for them, and all that type of stuff. So it's marvellous to see it.
It's a very healthy signpath of a community, isn't it, where you have so many different groups, so many different activities.
Yeah, it is. It makes it vibrant as well. I know communities are maybe villages and all that aren't going as good as they were, but still there's a good community spirit in most places, you know.
Pat, what attracted you to the radio?
I don't know. Jim just asked me about it one day, and
you mean Jim cornered you one day?
Well, no, he didn't corner me. No, he didn't. But he rang me one time about doing the. Actually, I think he rang Linda McGrath over in O'Connorsmith. She had come into the area, and she was involved in the community council, and she told you to ring me.
To ring you, yes.
Yeah, so
that's the community at work there. An example of the community at work.
She probably knew I'd know a lot more about space than she would have known.
That question alone actually is one of interest anyway, isn't it? What is it that brings this unusual collection of people with such a wide variety of interests?
We either love the sound of our own voices, or
are we very narcissistic?
We could be, especially when we listen back to each other. But no, to be serious, I think the people who contribute to the radio are interested in their community. They want to give something back. They want to typically communicate these things. Jim is the better person probably to ask, because he was the person who really got it going.
Yeah, I would say that what you said is correct, that there's a lot of people there who want to give something back to their community, and they want to, you know, they enjoy as well. I mean, whatever they're doing themselves. I mean, if it's Irish music, for example, or if it's country music or pop music or whatever, they like that. If they're interested in politics, they'll join El Politico, I suppose, yes, and do that, you know. So And a lot of people then are interested in community affairs and what's going on in the community. And we've a load of presenters, you know, for Saturday Chronicle who bring out that and shine a light on community activities every Saturday morning. Yeah. So it's, and that's right across East Clare, you know.
And you have the classical music on Saturday morning as well, and it's a very nice programme, and you have the country music in the afternoon, and you have the traditional music, so everyone is really covered.
And you've, last weekend now, we had, first time, we had a girl from Tulla.
Yeah, I heard that programme as well, yeah. She's very good, yeah.
Gen Z with Eve, and Eve is Eve O'Reilly, and she's 19. She's a student in UL or Ella, I'm not sure, in Limerick anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, she's big into music, so, okay, she wants to do a music programme, but not just a pop, you know, music programme, but she wanted musicians that she knows, that local musicians in Clare who have recorded tracks, young people I'm talking about now, and would play those. And then for her second show this week, she's brought in someone and they're discussing a whole load of issues to do with young people.
It's fantastic, isn't
so,
it?
So that's, and that needs to be encouraged.
Just before we go from the music, I'd just like to congratulate Owen and Ruth. Ruth is involved as well, wasn't she? In it,
so. Yeah, Ruth produced the show.
And Owen and Ruth and all the people involved.
Yeah. Now, gentlemen, when will the media programme win its award? That's what I want to know. One of the things we brought up just before, I know Pat is eager to get going on a rat story, but one of the stories we picked up on a few weeks ago was rural broadband, and we were explaining pipes and all sorts of things on that occasion. Yeah. But anyway,
we're not going back there, are we, David?
Except to say that Pat Hayes, Councillor Pat Hayes, is pursuing this, and he, I think, was the one who brought it up a few weeks ago, and he's pursuing it in the council. And they've taken, it's interesting actually, the news in the newspapers today or this week, how the role of the council, and we might be coming back to that, John, if you might remind us later. But a motion was brought by Councillor Hayes to actually ask the National Broadband Ireland for a report.
Great.
On when Clare will get connected to National Broadband. The whole article is about that call. The call has gone out. We await a response. But it's just interesting to see how long these things take and the response.
Now, and there's a photograph of Pat accompanying the article on The Champion.
He's looking very serious.
It's very serious now, Pat. The countenance suggests that you are deeply disturbed by this situation. But what drew my attention in particular, apart from the photograph, do you know? It was you spelled out three very definite requirements. A man now after our own heart, because one is, how are areas to be prioritised? How? We need the criteria. The timetable he's asking for. And thirdly, the processes to be used. Do you know?
Yeah.
Because it'll involve interplay between... Yeah. Obviously, between suppliers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Pat has given us, therefore, if you like, a chart. And the council have responded positively to it.
Mm.
And I gather we can expect...
In the coming weeks. So the council have forwarded this.
And I suggest, give an opportunity to our five good men and true who represent East Clare to follow this up with progress reports.
Yes, and I'm sure the newspapers will cover
it,
and we'll pick up on it as a result.
I see over in O'Callaghan's Mills anyway, for the last two or three weeks, there has been two or three events around with National Broadband Ireland on the side of them, and they have signs on all the place doing a survey.
So Callaghan's Mills will get priority anyway.
I don't know
what
they're going to do, but I don't know if they will or they won't. We'll be hoping they would.
Well, our next studio will be, one of our next studios will be opening in O'Callaghan's Mills. We have plans to open a studio there, so we'll obviously need...
You'll need good broadband.
We will.
That's nepotism now.
Is it anything to do with Pat's lovely wife's cooking, I wonder?
Yes, well, then there you are, so...
Yeah, well, it's. I mean, we've said it before here. It's so important to, for all sorts of things in East Clare and all over the country.
Yeah.
That we have access to good broadband. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's parts of here, parts of Scariff, parts of Dungrainy, parts of the Mills probably as well, where yeah. we're lucky to have, you know, fibre. But it's not everywhere, and it needs to be much more spread out.
Jim, you mentioned earlier a piece about the men's man day.
What no, it was David actually David. Mentioned,
well, David,
yes.
Well, David, I'm wearing the hat in support of the female.
You've got the wrong day, John. It's International Men's Day. It's the only day of the year now. Don't take it away from us.
I'm not going to take it away. But side by side is the role of women in the War of Independence.
Oh,
now,
yes,
they
yes.
are demanding, and rightly so, mm. they are demanding a platform, Jim and Pat.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
No gay. The project that they have come up with is a school-based project, okay? And we'd recommend that that people would look at the Champion. The project is designed to highlight the revolutionary women. I suppose, David, you're starting with Cumann na mBan.
Cumann na mBan.
What kind
right.
of research has been done on Cumann na mBan in County Clare? I know we're springing this on you, but
yeah,
have anything?
Not a great deal. Not a great deal from what I can tell. And so this project is a very welcome one. And why it is welcome in particular is it's involving the schools.
Yeah.
And the material is out there now. The Bureau of Military History in Dublin, which was a project set up in the 40s by the government to capture or record the memories of combatants,
yeah.
men and women, is all available online. The Bureau of Military History.
The Bureau of Military. Were you aware of that?
I was aware of that.
And I suspect this is how these school children will probably get a lot of the information
yeah.
from. And to my mind, it hasn't been done that I'm aware of. So it's a good first step. It's curious about the role of women. Women were not really combat. We think of Constance Markovics, and she
yeah.
carried a gun, and she was in the
yeah.
she mm-hmm. was actually a combatant. But women in general, those who were involved, typically were doing other types of activity, carrying messages in particular,
yes.
Carrying guns and ammunition as well,
yeah.
because
yeah.
the authorities were less likely to search a woman.
Looking after the safe houses.
Yeah.
You know, the
and the
yeah.
safe, and
feeding,
that's the forgotten
feeding.
One. That
my
is
aunt,
the forgotten one.
My aunt Sally was a member of Cumann na mBan up in North West Cumann. Her brother was in the actual flying column, okay?
Yeah.
And my other aunt worked in the post office in London during the time and brought over to Ireland two revolvers, you know. Her fiancé was an intelligence officer for Michael Collins in London, okay? And so she was always very proud afterwards of this participation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're right, women weren't searched, you see. So.
And unfortunately their role wasn't. I mean, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, Ireland was a male-dominated society.
Yeah.
And the type of history is often written from the victor's perspective. In this case, the combatants, the
yeah.
actual men themselves.
Yeah.
But interestingly, the memorial park, the memorial in Dungrainy to the East Clare Brigade and to the locals involved in that had always been dedicated to both the IRA and Cumann na mBan.
Yeah. Mm.
Which was, I think, interesting for the 1950s.
Indeed, indeed. And I can tell you the females were very prominent in the annual celebration of the revolutionary period. Do you know? Whether it was here in the church grounds or whether it was in the memorial park in Dungrainy.
Yeah.
The female presence was very manifest, wasn't it?
Yeah. Am I right in thinking that Constance Markovics would have been executed like the other leaders of 1916, but they wouldn't execute a woman?
Exactly. And and if they had, I mean, public opinion would really have turned against them. Public opinion was already, had already been turned against them. But they knew at the very least that if they went down that path, and De Valera being an American was also, they were also thinking about public opinion in America in that instance.
Yeah. But David, you as a professional historian would wonder, I'm sure, how come the story of Comyn na mBan hasn't been, if you like, suitably investigated and recorded?
There have now in the last 10, 20 years been national histories of Comyn na mBan. And certainly as a lecturer in history at UL, students, and particularly female students, are constantly... they wish to do their own projects on it.
Yeah.
I suppose, like everything else, the military history, the actual conflicts, the ambushes, the Bloody Sunday, which is 100 years ago this week, they tend to get more of the limelight. And so the other elements of the story are in the second seat at the back, if you know what I mean. They don't get as much prominence. But like this, it's great to see these sort of projects bringing it. And there are probably other elements of the of our past and our and the War of Independence that may not have been touched on yet. The role, for example, of younger people. Like if women could carry guns, what could a young child carry? Wouldn't be searched? So these are elements of the story that needs to be discovered.
Yeah. I suppose just as we're on it there, Williamstown element of Martyr stories, a big story there on the east and south southeast Clear Page from Fiona McGarry and Dan Danaher, all about the legacy of the Scarlet Martyrs and the 100th anniversary. In Williamstown House,
and they're going to they're going to have a more serious celebration in the spring time,
2021.
Will all these things? I hope they will, but will they all come to pass? You remember at the start of the lockdown, various funerals couldn't be held, memorial masses couldn't be held. More than a year will probably pass before we get back to normal, and let's hope we will be back to normal sometime in 2021.
Yeah.
Will we be able to catch up with all the things we've missed? John S. Kelly.
It's a good question.
I'd say all those they will all take place.
Because they're driven by very intimate local, involvement people.
Yeah. And a good lot of planning would have gone into
it.
Yeah.
I know there was a plan, I think, to reenact the boat trip.
From Williamstown to
Killaloe.
Yeah.
And, you know, to do that. In fact, we had been talking to the committee about it, like that we would broadcast live from
the boat.
From the boat.
There was a rush to see could we get...
How many presenters can you get into fit into the pool?
Would be the first time or the second.
No, indeed.
If there were awards going for Scariff Bay, would probably be up there with the best. But my only concern is we're moving into the period now, shortly in a year or two, into the commemoration of the Civil War.
Oh yes,
and how we remember the Civil War. And the danger is that the War of Independence commemoration will creep into that and the Civil War will be forgotten about. And the Civil War commemorations have to be handled carefully and sensitively. It has the potential for in certain quarters to resurrect some old differences. But I would hope that our local community groups would consider how we as communities across East Clare could think about the Civil War.
Very important. Very important. And there is a danger of the overlap.
Well, I think, whether it's Fine Gael or not, I suppose the possibility of you have a coalition between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil now, yeah. which maybe
it makes it easier. Pat,
it might be at the appropriate time that they would have come together
to bury the hatchet. Yeah.
And when you're coming into the civil right. war,
time. I think nationally it does make it a lot easier that the two civil war parties are in government together. I mean, they can't complain now
Indeed.
That one side is getting emphasis.
Just here before we go from it, I suppose O'Neillan has on page 18 of the Echo, Fish's apology is long overdue. It's all about it's an article. He's all about the bloody Sunday in Croke Park. Mm-hmm. You know, this week his uncle, granduncle was killed, Clancy, Paddle Clancy.
Yes.
And Dick McKee were murdered in Dublin Castle. So I suppose he has a nice article there on page 18 of the Echo.
Yeah. I mean, the British government could be apologising for the next 700 years if we kept going on it.
Globally.
Yeah.
But can you imagine the mood in London on the Sunday morning?
Oh, yes.
When it was realised that the top brass in the intelligence service had been wiped out.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean,
I was listening to something on the radio somewhere else about this, and a couple of weeks before the Bloody Sunday incident where the IRA did murder, 14 intelligence officers.
In Dublin, 14.
Intelligence officers. A couple of weeks before, the Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, had said, we have murder by the throat in Ireland, i.e. we have it under control.
Mm.
And, of course, this was a real bolt out of the blue, I suppose, for them. So you're right, John. I think there was shock, surprise. I don't think the historians that I was listening to on the radio said it didn't actually affect too much the British intelligence apparatus because these were individuals, but they had plenty of filing cabinets. So that information was in Dublin Castle. But the PR value, and the War of Independence is as much a PR war, a propaganda war, than anything else. You know, it's when De Valera and the IRA ordered the attack on the customs house, that was PR. There was no military strategic value to attacking a building. It was simply the fact that the IRA could strike at the heart of the British Empire in the second city of that empire.
And tell me, gentlemen, how is it that the castle authorities had no photograph of Michael Collins, couldn't recognise him? It was an extraordinary, you know, wasn't it, secretive operation that Collins ran.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anybody got any insight into how that was, if you like, constructed in Dublin? How is it someone surely didn't name Collins?
Yeah.
That there were no spies on the list.
He was a cute Cork fellow, wasn't he?
He was. I was just, you were talking there about striking at the heart of the British establishment. And I was looking at The Crown during the week.
Oh, yes.
On Netflix.
You're just a fan of The Crown, are you?
I would be very interested in that period now, but in 1979, some of this was featured.
Yes,
in August 1979, Lord Mountbatten was assassinated up in Sligo with a number of other people. Mm. Earlier that year, a Tory frontbencher, they weren't in government at the time, it was just a few weeks before the election of 1979, Airey Neave. Mm. And Airey Neave was in Westminster coming out of the car park when his car blew up.
Yeah.
And you could actually hear it, the sound, on the record of Parliament. But they were two, you know, strikes at the heart. One member of the royal family or a relation of the royal family is the other one in Westminster itself. And when you think then where Margaret Thatcher, she coming from that, and obviously, I think I'm not sure when the other thing happened, where the bomb at the Tory conference.
At the Brighton, yeah.
But that sure. might have been a bit later.
A little bit later, but not too far off.
But then you could see how could Margaret Thatcher allow, you know, whatever number of hunger strikers yeah. to die of hunger
yeah.
strike
yeah.
In 1981. And that, you know, it's history repeating itself to
but, yeah, I suppose you'll hear people saying, and I suppose it is true, that the British never learned, you know, they never learned from different phases of history.
I suppose imperial powers have that weakness.
Imperial powers, whether they're America, Britain, Japan,
yeah,
or anywhere.
The Pied Piper, Pied Piper of Hamelin. You remember from your school days, from your children's nursery days? Well, the Pied Piper has got a message to turn up in Dublin, because there's a problem in...
At the heart of our establishment.
Of our establishment. Now, Ken, let's see, what's his name? Ken Fox. I think it's Ken Fox.
Ken Fox.
Writing this week. He has an extraordinary title to it, the article.
It's in the Sunday Independent.
I'm going to let you tell them what the article heading is.
Rats take up residence in seat of power.
And we're not talking, are we, about the TDs?
Yeah, no. We know, we leave them out. 58,000 spent on pest control, record shows. But I think we were on slow-moving... snails last week, but we're on fast moving.
We're going to get a reputation now between snails and rats.
Pat, do you know how much money it cost you and the rest of us taxpayers to keep the House of Parliament clean of rodents?
Well, they're saying
58,000 quid.
Yeah.
That's what Rentokil got.
Yeah.
To control.
There must have been a lot of rats up there, was there? It's an old house, mind you. It's an 18th century house, and it's a big house.
It is a big house, yeah.
And, of course, it's not just Leinster House. It could be also across the road. The Oireachtas complex is very large. So Pat here has more information he wants to reveal to us.
The report also referenced a notorious incident where a rash was spotted in the Dáil Bear. It said this would be similar to a situation in the Dáil Bear when a rodent was hoarding bears of chocolate behind the kickboard in the bear.
Are you joking now?
He had a sweet tooth.
Yeah. Any particular type of chocolate, Pat?
I suppose he was stored it up for Christmas, probably.
He has a large family.
I'd say
to
it
look
was
after.
A Kit Kat.
Very good. Listen, will we put on a bit of music?
Or do.
Pat, any things we need to mark this week? Because you're usually good at finding out what we can... celebrate.
Petunia Clark, she was a 1960 pop star, and she was 88 on Sunday last. So maybe we'd have, she had a very popular...
John thought she had passed away, but she's in fine fettle.
She's in fine fettle, yeah. And she had a very popular song there in back in the 60s, Downtown. So okay. hopefully we'll have that.
Yeah, the great Petula Clark there. What age did you say she was, Pat?
88 on Sunday last.
88 last Sunday.
I wonder, can she still hit those high notes? I hope so.
We hope
indeed.
So.
Indeed.
Yeah, possibly not, but you never know.
We'll wish her a happy birthday anyway.
We will indeed.
And Jim, if you're listening, since we are, you know, stretching the hand across the board, across the water to Britain, I just wanted to tell you about something I came across very recently. As the population grew in England due to the Industrial Revolution and what have you, okay, there was a shortage of burial sites. You know, they're simply just... Mm. So some villages came up, you know, and with the idea of opening up old graves and taking the bones to a bone house. Okay, and then reuse the grave. But when reopening the coffins, one out of 25 had scratch marks under the top. I'm not joking. On the inside, realised that some people have been buried
alive.
Alive.
Yeah. Mm.
So what they did then in the village is that they would tie a string on the wrist of the corpse and bring that string, okay, out, up and through the soil. Okay? A very clever idea. Someone would have to sit outside then on the graveyard all night after the burial. Okay? It was referred to as the graveyard shift. And they'd listen for the bell sound, you see, going. Yes. And somebody, therefore, could be saved by the bell. So that was your origin of it, okay? Or you were considered to be a dead cert. But an interesting, had you ever come across that?
Never come across
it. You're a mine of information, John.
Yes,
very important historical data.
Can I just ask you, John, what's a bone house?
A bone house, where you...
you gather up the bones.
Bones, and you burn, crush them. Okay, and use them as fertilizer. Sold off then.
Human bones.
Why not? What?
It's just...
what do you think was happening in Nazi Germany?
They wouldn't be feeling it anyway, John. They'd hardly be feeling it from the being crushed up.
No. It's funny, and in, you know, for graves dug in old graveyards, like Minot, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go out to Minot when there's a grave been dug, or
the old grave,
the old, or the old cemetery, and you are you go out and have a look, you know, before somebody's buried there, and you look at the mound of earth, and it's absolutely full of bones.
Bones.
It stands to reason because these graveyards have been used for centuries in some cases, and they are family graves. And they're being used every generation. And so it's to be expected. Now, of course, that wouldn't happen because a grave is considered full after two plots or three plots are buried. And people are not tend not to be buried on top of each other anymore.
Yeah.
But I suspect it was regular enough.
In England now, there's a neighbour of mine, he was buried over in London. I think in one John, Dennis Stanley, he buried out of Buchan.
Oh, Dennis.
But they bury him down. They go down as deep as they can with the machine.
Right.
Yes.
And covering the person and someone else put on top of them again.
Well, I was in Montana, I witnessed a funeral in, this is United States, Montana, and in order, they didn't want to go too deep. Mm. And they even went so far as putting a coffin into a plastic container, in effect, to prevent contamination of water supply.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's amazing. It may only be a matter of time before these things come in here. With the way things are going, it is strange. But speaking of water and the Great Shannon River, we have news here on page 8 of the Clare Champion. Killaloe bypass works in pipeline, and this is of course the great intended bridge that will cross the River Shannon. One of the few times, of course, that bridges ever cross the River Shannon. It's rare that the Shannon gets a new bridge. This is, I think everybody knows, this is a long-running saga. But happily, we are told, it is expected the new Shannon River crossing, Killaloe bypass, an upgrade of the Ballina to Burt Hill regional road will take up to 3 years to construct, and that they will be going out to tender this coming spring. So it's very welcome for Killaloe and Ballina, because anybody waiting in the morning or coming home in the evening and witnessing those long lines of traffic.
You do that every day.
Before COVID, I was doing it.
Yeah, and what kind of a delay could you expect normally in the morning on the way to work?
On the morning, it's okay if you're coming from this side of Clare and going to Limerick. There's rarely a delay on the Killaloe side. It's when you're coming home on the Ballina side. For whatever reason, the way the traffic works out, you could be stuck there on a Friday evening, for example. I've been stuck there for 3/4 of an hour.
What?
Yeah. The traffic goes right back that road. So this is what I feel sorry for is sometimes the poor bridge. The bridge, which is a medieval bridge, now it's been patched up over the centuries, it gets a bit of a battering every now and again, particularly from lorries. And there's one corner of the bridge just there beside the canal, which is practically down once every three, six months. It's very sad to see. Mm. Hopefully, when this bridge and bypass is constructed in 3 years' time, is it 3 years it will take? Yes, 3 years to construct, that will be a thing in the future. And it'll make Killaloe and Ballina a lot more friendlier for tourists, for locals. Mm. People will be able to walk. I walked across that bridge sometimes and I see a lorry coming. I nearly went into the river.
Indeed.
Yeah. It's quite dangerous.
Yeah, it's costing 69 million.
And money 69. Well spent.
69.
The downside of that, there is a downside, I think, and the Gardaí might concur with this observation, that it facilitates speedy entry and exit into East Clare, the area we represent. Mm. And so that you, while we get a weekly report from the Garda on crime in the East Clare area, we find that we seem to come out quite well out of it.
Yeah.
But I'd be worried a little bit about perhaps, and that's where we come back again to the question of the camera.
Yeah, this is the proposal to erect a camera on the bridge, it could be this new bridge if that was effective.
Or on both.
And I think that would be a good idea. I remember the guards here on a Saturday Chronicle programme saying essentially the same thing. But there is another piece just beneath that Killaloe Bridge bypass piece, which says clarity sought over use of CCTV in detecting dumping. And this is the same problem that I think the erecting cameras have, because the Data Protection Commissioner has concerns about the use of cameras. This is in relation to detecting dumping. And Councillor Alan O'Callaghan is here pictured. It's interesting to see the various councillors pictured and the poses they strike. Compared to Pat Hayes, Councillor O'Callaghan looks less formidable, but more determined.
More relaxed.
Yeah, yeah.
And friendlier, I have to say.
And what?
And a little bit more friendly. I think I'll approach him.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's made the issue that the council are worried that if they erect CCTV and illegal dumping is caught on the camera, that prosecutions may fail because this evidence may not be permissible in the court.
Would someone explain to me the sense of that?
It's very hard, John, to... It's very hard to see the sense, you know.
I mean, so is it that cameras are put there for a specific purpose? We'll say speeding cameras. Are there to detect speed. So you could actually commit a murder in full view of this camera, and the evidence from the camera couldn't be used.
It's unbelievable.
It is.
Yeah. With everything. And all you need is a good lawyer. If the law on monitoring is being misapplied, and if it's not being applied properly, then it can't be used in evidence. So that's why I think the council have to be very careful. They're now writing to the Garda Síochána to see if they can actually do this. What is barmy, in fact, is that each single council have to do this. Seemingly in Tipperary, it's possible for them to do it and there's no problem and the cases are being brought before the court. In Clare, across the lake, it's a bit different. Why there can't be a...
We need an answer to that, don't we? And our listeners need an answer.
And I wonder, we're talking about this new bridge and the old bridge as it stands at the moment. Why cannot a camera be put up to detect crime?
Yeah.
To keep the people of East Clare, you know, safer. I'm just wondering what percentage of people in East Clare would object to cameras going up on the bridge at Killaloe.
And if we had more instances, I think, on your point now, Jim, if we had more instances of direct democracy, where when the council elections are held or when, you know, that you have, like you have in some countries, a list of other things where you're invited to vote. So that as well as electing candidates, you are actually also expressing an opinion on, for example, issues which affect your area. And I think...
Well, that would be direct democracy. And
And what do you think of that?
it would be an interesting experiment. They have it in America, just in Switzerland and other places. But what struck me, coming back to it from what I said earlier, what struck me about reading this week's newspaper was the role of the county councillor and the role of the council executive. And there is a report there, a councillor asking about spending in County Clare. It strikes me that one of the major roles of councillors is not actually to make decisions. It's keeping the executive members of the council in check and keeping them responsible. The decisions are made by this permanent civil service, the executive. Mm-hmm. And the councillors have very little to do except occupy our newspapers, try to get attention, represent their constituents, which is a big part of their job. But they can't actually achieve as much as I suspect they would like.
But it would be interesting to know. It would be interesting to know what the councillors themselves, again, we're into an academic piece of research. Mm. Could we establish what extension of power the councillors would like to take back? Okay.
This was set up in the 1920s by our central government because they were not willing to trust local politicians to make informed decisions as they would have viewed it. And that's why they established an executive role for the council. Now, very slowly, it's changing a little bit in the major cities with the election of mayors, where politicians who become mayors would subsume some of the powers that are currently given to. But how that affects counties like ourselves and rural places like ourselves is we've actually seen, I think, an erosion of local democracy by the removal of some urban district councils.
Indeed.
So it is an issue. And
can we come back to this at a later stage when COVID has disappeared off the scene and we have our five councillors in?
Because I think democracy is useless if there isn't a facility for expression of ideas.
Exactly.
Other than the council chamber, obviously.
Yeah.
The public need a forum, whether it's a newspaper, whether it's a radio station, whatever it is.
Yeah. So we need, this stemmed out of now, lad, out of the question about the cameras and the restrictive practices that, are forced on the public in relation to positioning and placing of cameras. Mm. We need to find out more about how that process came about.
But David mentioned good lawyers or good legal representation, and maybe it is a legal question.
But I think it is.
And there is no reason why legal questions can't be sorted and solved to everyone's satisfaction.
But you'd imagine that if there's a camera up, and if there's two or three different someone breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
If they're jumping, maybe they're doing something else.
Yeah.
It could be used for that. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing that if you have just put it up for one thing and that it can't be used for something else, it doesn't make sense.
Not at all. Okay, John, you have another
very interesting photograph on the paper and an accompanying, have you got that as well, Pat?
I have, yeah.
Accompanying article by Lynn Kelleher. Did you know that the Fitzgerald side of the JFK dynasty came from outside Bruff?
Yes.
Now we do. If you're the silence is pregnant with meaning. If you were to take a vox populi out on the streets of Scariff, or Ennis, or Limerick, with regard to where did Honey Fitz and the Fitzgerald, where did they come from? They'd know where the Kennedys is straight away. Yeah, yeah. And the Kennedys down in South Wexford, they've been cashing in on that.
Fair Bruff, play to them.
Absolutely. Oh,
And I suspect Mr. Biden's relatives will be cashing in.
Balladrine and Ballina, I should say.
And Louth as well.
Now listen, imagine this. A digger cleaning up the ditch.
Yeah.
Do you know the way diggers operate, Pat?
What's
revealed? The ruin of a house. And the local historians established with good research, it is the home of the Fitzes. Fitzgeralds.
Back to the 1830s.
Can you imagine, if, by the way, now, if this were beyond And I always felt that anytime I was in the States and we go visiting historic sites and what have you. And the Americans are very patriotic, no question about it, and they're into symbolism in a big way, and also their interpretive centres are everywhere. And I feel that if George Washington happened to relieve himself on a wall down somewhere during the Civil War.
Be a national monument.
There would, and an interpretive centre there as well. I'm not joking. You know? So we need to...
So because the Fitzes were doing a lot of urinating in this house, are you suggesting... What actually are you suggesting?
I'm not suggesting it. The article is suggesting it and reflecting the actual local communities of Bronx. Yeah. They're dying to get going on this.
Yeah.
The trees are removed now.
Yeah.
This is the early stage of the clearance.
But do you think the young people out there...
Oh, what good manipulation you could
JFK,
get them.
With JFK, like, would they know the significance of JFK? Well, like, for a certain generation, obviously.
I tell you what now, if the local GAA, West Limerick or East Limerick, football, Junior B... If they were sponsored by the Honey Fitzes, that would get the interest of young people. So you've got it, Mark.
Some of us though are. Some of us were delighted to see the back of the Fitzgeralds.
And oh my God! Go on, Jim. What is that now?
Why is that?
Well, there is evidence, and you're the historian, David.
I'm being picked on a lot tonight. Between coming a man and funeral coffins.
There is evidence that in or about the year 1280, the Collinses were cleared out of West Limerick by none other than the Fitzgeralds.
You see why we'll have trouble with the Civil War if we go back to the 1280s.
Pat, you moved across the border as well, didn't you?
Oh, I did.
On your way down to the bottom of romance in North Cork to meet Mairead.
And he came back twice as fast.
But can I just reassure you that the Flemings tried to come in here in the 1160s and are still trying to sort you out.
Pat, you have something else there.
Not just the farmhouse, it was the residence of Mary Linehan, one of JFK's great-grandmothers, before she moved down the road after marrying her neighbour Edmund Fitzgerald in 1828. She gave birth to Mary Fitzgerald in 1832, but is thought to have died soon afterwards. The parental Kennedy connections in Wexford are well documented, but the Limerick town is where the if in JFK name originated. Local historians have traced back five generations of the Fitzgerald side of the family in the picturesque town and produced three of his mothers. Rose Fitzgerald's grandparents are three of JFK's great-grandparents. The ruin in Palatine Road outside Bruff was hidden for decades by trees. The one-story cottage has trees going through the floor, but the three walls and two front windows and a wood door have survived.
Yes.
So it's a good story from Bruff, yeah. Okay.
David, sorry, John, go ahead.
Go ahead. No.
No, something over near where you live, David. A traffic problem.
Yeah, page 8 again of the Champion, and again just highlighting the role of councillors, by the way, in bringing things to the attention of the executive. And this is Councillor Joe Cooney, who highlights the safety measures outside Bodike National School, and anybody passing from Bodike to Broadford will know the school there at Bodike, and will know the narrowness of the road and how busy it can get in the morning and particularly at collection time. It is dangerous, and especially coming to that junction there, and it's an important point. They are proposing the acquisition of additional land for safety purposes. I don't know what's going to happen. But it's even though it's a small school, there are still quite a few young children. And wouldn't it be just awful if there was an accident?
Oh, God, yeah.
And the regret that people have.
Yeah.
No, so it's important, and it goes back to the role of councillors about highlighting these issues. It's a pity, though, that they haven't the capacity themselves to be able to order or to instruct or make the decision on behalf of the council. They rely on the civil servants there.
Good point now, though.
But you imagine, like, you know, those things kind of come in under community efforts. And if the people, if there's a few people there, you know, with a bit of interest and a bit of going, they might be able to,
but I think,
to organise something that
I
would.
I think, Pat, they are, they're doing their best because Bedeyk National School Parents Association are involved.
Yeah.
What they want is probably the compulsory purchase of a bit of land somewhere. Yes. That's something they can't do by themselves.
Yeah.
And, of course, they need the council's cooperation.
Okay. There are a number of other things, and we're not going to have time to get to them. Trump fires top election security official. Trump is firing people. Goodall.
That's unbelievable. You know,
but
came
sure, he started, didn't he, in television as the apprentice. You're hired and you're fired. So it's... It's true to form there. And of course, a cut, a person or an animal becomes dangerous when they're cut and when they're down and defeated.
Yeah.
And this is exactly true to form now. Yeah. He's sacking everybody that he can get that says no to him.
And I know we intended talking something about Brexit this evening, but we're not going to get there now because the clock has caught up with us. The Clare Greenway I see is going to tender.
I think we'll come back to that next
week.
We will.
I see in the Clare Herald, it's on in the Clare Herald there. Pat Flynn has a piece, Scariff Limerick Greenway moves to preliminary design stage.
Yeah.
So we'll start with that next week.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Listen, thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you, John S., Pat, and David.
Thank you, Jim.
For your valuable contributions again this evening. We look forward to joining all our listeners again next Sunday afternoon. We're slightly late today because you probably heard the Scariff Martyrs documentary was on just before. And if you missed just before us, and if you missed it, well, then please go to the podcast page where you will find parts one and two of that documentary put together over the last number of weeks. To mark the 100th anniversary of the assassination of the Scariff Martyrs. So until next week, this is Jim Collins saying thank you very much for listening. And please, again, to remind you, do support your local papers.